Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
I pushed it once.
I did a manual fade too. That was amazing.
I know, that
fade.
Was pretty nice. You're getting artistic with the fades. I like it.
I might bring it
back. Men
over,
detail. Back Wake up Hollywood. I'm Nikhil Carulla.
You can talk over it.
Well, no, I brought you it just ruined in. It. You know, there was a moment.
You can't
I was
ruin
getting
show.
All revved up.
You can't too. Ruin this show. It's impossible.
Wake up Hollywood. I'm Nikhil Carulla. Eddie Pence. How are you, buddy?
I'm good.
I never say your last name, first and last name. And
you want to avoid my last name in this day and age.
Wow. He's not, well, he is actually that bad. You know, the vice president, he's got a very smug look. There's nothing worse than a person that has a smug look on their face. It just makes you want to just slap him across the face.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Give him a wedgie. Something. Yeah. Something bad. But how was your week?
So
let's
big.
Not talk politics. That's a brutal
That's
game.
A good time. That's good times.
How was your week? What did you do? Anything fun?
I was at Disneyland.
Oh, my God,
That's
yes.
why I wasn't here last week.
That's right. It's been a couple weeks.
Yeah, it's been a couple weeks.
So tell me about Disneyland.
No,
you got to tell the story, too.
What story?
Well, about you taking Colton to school. Oh, you got to tell people that.
Yeah. I took him. We acted like it was a regular school day, and so we got him ready for school, and then we drove him to school, and then we just kept driving past the school to Disneyland. That's what we did.
You know, growing up in an Indian household, that never happened. It wasn't like, we're going to take you to school and then we're going to go to Disneyland. It was like, we're going to take you to school and give you extra homework so you study. That was my household.
And then you went to music.
I know. See? That was me fighting back. So maybe Colton's going to be like a doctor or something.
He's actually, we had a letter. I guess they're going to test him for being gifted.
Oh, hey. Not to be
Not for me. I don't know where he got it from. Not for me.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I guess.
So what, like gifted in
I guess he's really good at math.
Intelligence?
Really good at math.
Okay.
Which I am horrible at math.
Is Tracy good at math?
She's good. I wouldn't say like
she's average?
Not, she's not like Doogie Howser
so,
good.
So he may be Doogie Howser good?
I guess.
Is
I don't know.
Is there a chance that your son is Doogie Howser at math?
I don't know.
Dude, he may have to be trained as our accountant.
I don't know.
Eddie.
It wouldn't
Eddie.
Be hard to balance my checkbook because there's nothing in it.
You know what, though? It's like if he's really good at numbers, he could go into music. I'm just saying.
No.
And he does play. He does slap on the bass.
No, he's not good. He doesn't really have any musical. You can tell when someone's got like musically inclined.
You never know. You know, like if you had judged me on my clarinet skills, you would have been like, there's no
yeah,
way.
Yeah, but like a sense of rhythm and like.
Oh, but dude, clarinet was tough. It was tough for me. Those are some dark days in the music world for me. I mean, you know, let me tell you the story. I wanted to play saxophone. Saxophone, oh man, I wanted to play saxophone. And I wanted to play tenor saxophone because it's like really gritty. But when you're like 10 years old, 11 years old, lugging a tenor saxophone is not that much fun. So my dad saw me, and the tenor saxophone was like big as I was. And he was just like laughing. He was like, you know what? You really should play this old clarinet I've got stored away. And I was like, oh, man, that's way lighter. That sounds like a plan. But, I sucked at that instrument. And, like, I used to just fake practice. You know, my dad would open the garage door coming home, and I would take out the clarinet and make it look like I'd been practicing there for hours. And I'm sure he came home and he's like, my kid is not getting better at this instrument.
He practices so much. He's so bad.
So much. But you know the funny thing is? My brother did the same thing. He did the exact same thing, so I kind of learned it from him. So it's kind of ironic that I did end up going into music because I quit piano because I was tired of studying classical music. I was terrible at clarinet.
Mm-hmm.
I was squeaking left and right. I mean, dude, it was bad. It was bad. But somehow, guitar found its way and was like, dude, you don't have to be a nerd musician anymore. Now you can be a rocker. Yeah.
Nice.
So you never know. Colton could be I'm a musician genius.
I don't know.
No?
I don't care.
You're like, meh, we'll see.
That doesn't matter.
So, does he have an interest in it?
In music?
Yeah.
No.
No, I mean math.
Math? No, I don't know.
Is he? How do you know he's just exceptionally gifted?
Hey, I don't know. The teacher just sent home a letter. He's good at his homework. He just whips through his homework, his math homework. And we got a letter saying they want to test him for being gifted. And I'm like, okay.
What if he's cheating? Will that break your
heart? No, it won't break my heart. I don't care. If he wants to be gifted, fine. If not.
What if he's cheating off the Asian kid?
Fine. I hope the Asian kid's at the test, too, so he can cheat off him then. I don't care. I don't care if he's gifted or not. That doesn't matter to me.
Are you going to treat him any differently if he's gifted?
No.
What if he's like, Dad, I'm gifted. Leave me alone.
I'll never tell him.
You'll never tell him, but he'll know.
Why would he know?
Because he's taking the test.
Knows at that age, they're just getting tested left and right. They don't know what it is. They don't walk him in there and go, now you're being tested to see if you're gifted. They don't give him like a spiel about it.
You know, I'd like there to be a documentary of, like, you know, all those tests that they did give us in elementary school to see if we were gifted and this and that. And to see the kids that did well, what they're doing now.
Yeah, but half those kids, because I know when I took those tests in like third or fourth or fifth grade, I was just like filling out the dots to finish the thing.
Me too.
So I could have been gifted. I don't know.
So you just didn't apply yourself.
How many of those kids slipped through the system because they're just like, fine. You brought the soundboard,
dude,
back?
I have to, you know?
It's been gone forever.
Come on. Monkeying around. We love it. Hey.
God damn it.
It's a soundbite off.
I have a much better soundboard.
It's just louder.
It's better.
God damn it.
Who is
I'm
that?
The gangbang.
So much better.
You must bow down to the almighty Bunghole.
Wait, so what did Colton say when he pulled up to Disneyland?
He was just, well, he knew before we got there because it's a 45-minute drive.
Well, he didn't ask, like, where are we going?
Yeah, we told him Disneyland.
Oh, why did you spoil the surprise?
Because, like, he's like, where am I going, Dad? And we're just supposed to sit there in silence for 45 minutes on the five?
No, you could have said we're going to Uncle Larry's house.
Oh, the uncle you never met
in
Orange County?
Yeah, well, you could have said, oh, Nikhil's got a big concert.
No, you drive past, like, Dad, where are we going to school? Because we're going to Disneyland. Ah.
Oh, so then you...
You don't drive for an hour in an awkward car situation.
Yeah, but then the surprise is done. It's like, then
you can't keep the
drive.
Surprise.
It's like,
you'd be a terrible father.
Probably.
Why don't we stop him at school, Dad? And then just, you don't talk to him?
It's just like, silence! Just smack him with a ruler. All right, so what ride did he go on first?
Yeah.
He must have been so excited, dude.
He was pretty excited. What did he ride first?
Was he like making an order?
It's such
a
long freaking day, man.
We're going to do Space Mountain.
It was like 12 hours. It's so long.
Man.
We got there at like 9:30 and we left at like 11 at night.
You know what's cool about that though? As a kid, those are your best nights of sleep.
So long.
It's so long for the parents, I'm sure. Because you're like, dude, I was ready to go 5 hours ago. And they're like, let's go on one more ride. And you're like, oh,
he's not
God.
Like that, though. He was kind of like around 9:30. He's like, so, when are we leaving?
Really?
Yeah. Oh, I'm like, man. We're not leaving. We're going until they close at Disneyland. I don't know when we're coming back here. It's a fortune to get in here.
Yes, that's true. How much are tickets now? $100.
Okay. 110 for adults. Oh, 104 for
they
kids.
They just keep hiking it up, man. That's
when
crazy.
I moved out here in 1997, an adult could get to Disneyland for $45.
Okay.
I'm 20 years later,
I'm beat that.
It's three times the
when
amount.
When I grew up and went to Disneyland as a child, I remember this. For California residents, you can get a ticket for $22.
Yeah.
Crazy. Did you see
that
my
doesn't, that doesn't that's way beyond the price of like the
speaking of
the
Disneyland,
rise of inflation.
Did you see my little text message? I went and visited Walt Disney's little grave.
Yeah, yeah.
Forest Lawn.
Nice.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
You know, they don't tell you where he's buried. They don't tell anybody where anybody's buried.
Yeah, because they don't want people
doing exactly what
yeah.
I did. Yeah, but I broke,
doing
the,
what you
I
did.
Broke the law, man. No, it was actually pretty cool because I hunted it down. Like, I tried going maybe about 3 months ago, and I did not find him. And then
why were you trying to find him?
Just, you know, he's like one of the most iconic figures ever, and he's like full of imagination. I just wanted to see, well, you know, everybody knows Disneyland, but they don't know where he's sleeping now. Yeah. Huh?
His head's somewhere, right? Don't they?
But you know what?
I got to
tell
you. Or something?
I've seen a lot of, you know, I actually have gone and visited quite a few graves. And his is one of the coolest. It's like this beautiful little park. It's like a mini park in Forest Lawn. And it's like, dude, this guy, he had it going on. He had, he knew what was up. And yeah, so you have to like hunt it down on a map. I had to look it up, like look up all kinds of stuff on the internet.
Wasn't he also an informant during the McCarthy era for When people were trying to blacklist people, he was ratting people out?
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. I've heard a lot of rumors.
I've heard a lot of bad things about Walt Disney.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of bad things about it. But it's like, how could somebody be that pissed off and evil?
I don't know.
It's like drawing Mickey Mouse and making a fortune. I mean,
really? I don't know.
You think he's just like one of those like bankers, like rich bankers? It's like,
I don't know.
Soon everybody I've heard a lot of bad things.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of hard to believe, you know? Once you get to that, like, monstrous, you know, of success, that monstrous success level, you just, I don't know, people start, you know, soon people will be like, oh, that Eddie Pence.
I wouldn't know about success.
So. I've heard, you know, he had that sex
change operation. I'm doing a free internet radio show on a Tuesday night. I don't know anything about success.
Hey, hey, you're successful to me, man.
God damn it!
Because you're good at what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, let's bring up our guest. I think she just arrived. Miss Reem Adan. The comedian.
Ew.
You like that little intro? Yeah, yeah. Oh, our studio audience loves you already.
Ovation,
I know. You see that? How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you guys?
So you, we're good. Eddie, how are you? She's asking you too.
Oh, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah. See.
Cover from Disneyland.
Yes. You know.
He doesn't. He look like he just came from Disneyland.
Yeah, the endorphins.
I'm tired.
The haircut really looks like.
What
you
is
know.
The? I just don't have any product in my hair.
I'll give you some props.
Your hair is like a quarter inch long. You don't have to do anything to it.
Hey, you leave my Indian
then
afro
leave
alone.
My hair alone. I wore a hat.
No, it looks cute. Your little headphone hair. It looks. I see the little kid in you.
Oh my God.
It's my anyways, last show. Reem, how are you?
Oh my God, I'm excellent.
You have been rocking the comedy scene. And you just started, like, you just started, you said in June, right?
In June of last year, yeah.
And you just, like you must have been just out of your head a little bit and just said, you know what, I got to do this now. If I don't do this now, I'm never going to know.
Yeah, you know, a little thing called Trump happened, and I was like, oh, God, I got to do this. Like, this is not comedic material and ammo, then. I don't know what is. No, yeah, but in all seriousness, I did my first open mic technically in February, but then I took a break and then did my first actual stand-up in June. And it just seemed to be like the perfect time. The stars aligned for everything to happen. I'm a Muslim Arab Iraqi woman.
That's right. So, I remember.
Yeah, right?
Are you born in America or are you from
Iraq? Yeah, I was born in Fort Collins, Colorado, but my parents are from Baghdad. I lived in the Middle East for 4 years in a country called Bahrain, which no one knows. No one's ever seen it on a map. Some people do now. But I moved there a week before 9/11, so that was a crazy
seriously?
Experience. Yeah. It's funny because you think of, you know, racism, and then reverse racism is just as bad.
Totally.
Yeah, you know, when you're considered, you know, the only American in the Middle East, even though my parents are Arab, it was just like crazy.
Yeah, you're the outsider.
Yeah, which I've always been. I think I've always straddled, you know, both cultures, even religiously. My mom is Shiite and my dad is Sunni, which is like...
Wow, how'd they get together?
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
That's kidding.
Wow.
That's like the
Roman see, the Juliet. World can live in harmony.
Right?
You know,
exactly.
You know what? It can't because it's all around love.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And the funny thing is, like, governments want us to think like, oh, let's be separate. Let's be different. You know, bullshit.
Yeah.
That we don't need that bullshit.
Mm-mm.
So, anyways, you moved there. How old are you then? If you don't mind me asking.
I'm 26 now. So when I moved there, it was 2001. So I was like 10, 11.
Dude, that's crazy.
Nuts. But I was like, it gives you like a great perspective, especially when you're doing something like stand-up comedy, because you have such an outsider's point of view in a lot of like cultural and religious and social events and activities. So you can really comment on everything and like poke fun at it. And so when the time came for me to start doing stand-up, I was like, I got things to say. Let's go.
You're like, I got plenty of
so you were totally motivated by what was happening politically? Is
I
that what got you?
It's what ignited the fire. I will say, though, like when you start doing stand-up, it's basically storytelling, right? And the first thing you think about is, who am I and what can I tell people about myself and my experience? So, I mean, right now I'm bubbling it down and making it sound a lot more formal than it actually was, you know?
Right.
When I started, I was like, well, shit, I just want to make jokes. I want to do stand-up comedy.
It takes people, like, you know, and when you first get up, you just want to, like, I just want to make people laugh and be funny.
Exactly.
Then you realize, no, I got to do more than that.
Exactly. Well, I was like, oh, God, I keep talking about, like, the same thing over and over again, like, who I am and, like, who my parents are. My dad is, like, my number one character in all my stand-up, which he actually came to one of my stand-up shows for the first time.
I just saw the picture. Stand-up. I was like, ooh, that must have been crazy for him.
God. So, literally, he sees my stand-up show, and he was, you know, I've done stand-up at, like, Comedy Store and a bunch of other, like, more, you know,
reputable places.
Yeah, and this was, like, a... kind of hole in the wall comedy shack, but my parents were in town from Colorado, so I was like, you guys gotta come, you have to see me do this thing I call stand-up. And at the end of it, my dad, he walks over to me. He's like, you know, you did great. You are so smart. You should be a lawyer.
Do anything but this.
Right? He's like, that is
like I need to punch myself in the face.
Right? I'm like, yeah, that's not the point, but cool. That works. The problem was, though, too, he was talking about how he doesn't really like the state of environment. He's like, you know, you're doing good. But the girl before me, and, you know, a lot of female comedians do this where they try to get that shock value. And
yes.
Dirty,
it's the
right?
Sarah Silverman thing. Yeah, totally.
So just imagine my parents with their ginger ale in the audience, sipping it, and they just hear like a bunch of words. Like,
oh, where was the show?
Yeah. It was at Sal's Comedy.
Oh, Sal's Comedy.
Yeah. I walked in and I was
Was there an audience?
There was, yeah.
Wow.
There were, like, 40 people.
Wow.
So it was like a smaller show. I wish my parents would have seen me in like Comedy Store main room or something.
Yeah, but you know what? It's like as you get bigger and you start packing more rooms, those small rooms, you're actually going to, like, savor. And that experience is going to be
I don't know if you'll savor Sal's.
Well, you know what? I played at the Coconut Teaser, which is not even a venue anymore. And I remember those moments, and I do savor those. I'm like, you know what? Those were
I remember some of my smaller shows. I'm like, I don't ever need to play here again. No, I don't agree all big. But
there's some places.
There's some places you're just like,
I don't want you to pay.
This is terrible. I don't ever need to come back.
I've never even been there.
It's on Melrose.
Oh, okay.
It's a pizza shop. And then in the back is a room. It's a nice, it's actually not a bad room. It's not a bad, it's a decent sized room. There's worse places you could do stand up comedy.
But you just have to get up. Like, that's the whole thing with stand up, right?
Yeah, so I was trying to explain to my dad, you know, like, this might not be the best environment.
This isn't the end game, Dad.
Yeah, but it helps you, you know, it's a stepping stone to where you want to go, right? You know. Ultimately, and we were watching Dave Chappelle stand up on Netflix, and I was like, see, that's the end goal. Like, and you do these little shows so you can refine your craft, and then you get there. So,
I heard Chappelle got like 90 million for
60 million. I think it was 60 million for three show specials or four specials.
Like, so tell your dad, you know, it can happen. Yeah, it can happen.
No, he was like, I believe you, but once I see the contract,
he's like, you know, that's the other thing, too. It's like, I grew up with Indian parents, and it was tough to tell them. I mean, like, a lot of people are like, oh, man, how you doing music? I'm like, you know, the music part was the easy part. The hard part was telling my parents I wanted to be in a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
Like, you know this. Oh, it's just it's like a different upbringing. Like, we are trained and raised to be successful as a lawyer, a doctor, an engineer.
Housewife.
Yes, that too. Mary Rich.
Best job in the world.
We don't. You're like.
See, I just had white parents. And they're like, whatever. So whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do, we'll support you.
When did you tell your parents you want to be a comedian?
I don't know. It was never a thing. It was never like.
Mom and Daddy Pence, your son wants to be a stand up comedian.
It wasn't a thing.
It was just like, hey.
Did you?
Yeah, this is what I want to do.
I know it was a thing for you. Did you have to? Like, it was a thing for me. I remember that dinner.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I, you know, had like a coming out party or anything, but it was the first phone call I had was just telling them that I didn't open my.
Oh, you did it over the phone. That's easy.
Well, they live in another state.
Okay.
So,
but you could have gone in person, like like Thanksgiving something.
I mean, it's not that big of a bomb to drop.
Right.
No error put intended. Yeah. I just remember them thinking it was like a hobby at first, so they're totally fine with it.
I think most parents assume it's just a hobby or a phase, and then you start really doing it, and then they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly. But really doing it means making money at it, so technically I'm not really, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, I just kind of told them about it, and they're like, oh, that's cool. And then I think like their number one concern was like, you're not going like filth comedy, are you? And I was like, no.
Right.
No.
You're like half filled comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
I may swear a little bit. No, and I do notice that too. Like a lot of comedians, you know, I've seen Eddie a bunch, and some of the people that you perform with, maybe people that you don't even know, they come up and it's just like, I love filthy comedy. I do. I think it's hilarious. But when you bank on it, like I notice a lot of comedians bank on it, and it's like, I want there to be variety. Like what I do love about Chappelle is he can go up and just do the filthiest set, and then an hour later at another club, do a completely clean set. And you're like, dude, when you can do both like that, you're so badass.
Exactly. And I love Chappelle, too, because I think he's Muslim, right?
I don't know.
He is Muslim.
Really?
Yeah, he said something about, in his last Netflix special, I think episode two, he was talking about how he and his sister were out, and his sister was in, like, full Muslim garb and stuff. I'm pretty sure that's why he, like, disappeared for 10 years.
Wow. I didn't know that.
To Africa. I could be completely lying. But I
have no idea.
That's what happened.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So what was the, like, who was the comedian that kind of started it all for you?
That brought me in. I love Russell Peters.
He's one of my favorites.
He's amazing. So when you're a first generation, you know, kid, there's not a lot of entertainment that you can watch with your parents.
Yeah.
I feel like you ever wonder who reads like the back of the movies and sees those like ratings, like rated R and stuff? It was my parents. It was us. Because I would literally get blamed personally if I brought home a movie from Blockbuster and there was like too much nudity or something cussing. Or that my favorite was like my parents would like make us like down once there was like a sex scene. Like, we would never acknowledge it. They would just be like la 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 la. And like, you'd look down like I didn't even
see this. You know what? We had very parallel. We had a lot of the same stuff. My mom would just go, she'd make it real awkward. She'd be like, cut. Like, while you're like, you know, and you're like a small pubescent boy, you're like, ooh, Kelly LeBrock, yeah.
Right?
Ooh, she's hot. And then you hear your mom go, cut.
That's
yes. She would just
cut.
Be like, cut. Like, you can't look. You can't,
oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
She would play director a little bit.
So what my parents would do is they would make us watch Titanic over and over again. And it was when we were living in the United States, so it was like the full uncensored Titanic. But I didn't even know Rose like showed her boobs until I was like 18. Like I finally started rewatching, I was like, oh.
You're like, there's a nudie scene.
Right.
Eddie was just like, give me all the nude scenes in every movie. What? I'm just kidding. Were your parents ever like that with any X-rated?
No, I mean,
nothing. Your parents were like super cool.
Yeah.
Super laid back.
Yeah. I think the first sex scene that popped on while we were watching a movie as a family was Purple Rain. We're watching Purple Rain.
Nice, and I'm wearing Prince.
Oh, like, were you?
Yeah.
That was the first one, and then like that came on, and we're all just sitting there like, "What's happening?" Because I didn't know that. I was thinking, I mean, I was probably like in third grade. When did Purple Rain come out on VHS? And so my mom just ran over and turned the TV off, and that was it. And then she waited like 10 minutes and then turned it back on and we finished watching it. And like, okay. And then we never talked about what happened.
Oh, so you did have some censoring then.
Yeah, but there was no discussion about it.
Well, we didn't have a discussion. My parents didn't sit down and say.
Well, there was no even like scene made or like, cut, don't watch.
Well, she made a scene.
She just walked
TV.
Over and turned it off and then
well,
turned it back on.
Well, I guess our parents were cooler than your parents.
Well, no, and then turned it back on and that was the only time that ever happened. And then that was all I remember.
And you never asked? You were a pretty inquisitive kid. I'm
no,
sure.
I would just watch it later and see what the missed part was. Not a big deal.
That's crazy.
I'm just imagining a scene of my parents being like, you know, when a man and a woman really love each other, nothing happens. It's just blank. Turn off the TV.
I love your Arabic accent is spot on. It's ridiculous.
It's really not, though. My dad pointed it out. My mom, too. They're like, we don't sound like that.
You're like, yeah, I know, but you
like,
do.
But, like, I can't do your accent, so for all intents and purposes, yeah. This is what you sound like.
That's crazy. All right, well, let's get to some of your comedy. Let's play some stuff. What are we going to play first? Eddie?
A dealer's choice? I don't know.
Dealer's choice? Is that cool?
Sure, go ahead.
Which one you want? A Mexican Muslim in Trump's America.
It.
Here we go.
I'm Reem. I'm Muslim. Now that Trump is president, I'm screwed. Not only am I Muslim, but I'm also Arab and Iraqi. Only thing worse than being those three things in America today, simultaneously looking Mexican. I do feel bad for Mexicans, though, because Arabs, I mean, at least you're only treated like a minority in person, but you're actually considered Caucasian on paper. How's that for a loophole, Mr. President? Which my dad is pretty excited about, as if it somehow means we're white. He got into a fight with me recently when he found out I lied on my college applications identifying as Asian, because technically, the Middle East is on the continent of Asia. He's like, no, drop the Asian. We are just as cock as anybody else in this country. My mom's like, don't be afraid of the cock. I love my parents, though. My dad's actually my only source of news these days, because there's nothing funnier than watching your 65-year-old Muslim father repeat things that Trump says without using offensive words that aren't approved. Like he was like, this guy is disgusting. He is assaulting women, grabbing them by the front butt. Although my parents, it's hard being Muslim. I don't know what's in store for us Muslims. I really don't. Well, what I do know is I'm not taking a religion test because I'd fail. I would score so low even ISIS wouldn't take me. But, like, I get why Trump hates Muslims. If I had a very tall tower, I would be pretty nervous, too. There's so many misconceptions out there, though. Like, people think Islam is a very violent religion when it literally means peace in Arabic. Or people think we hate all non-Muslims, which is ridiculous. It's just the Jews. But regardless of what you believe, it's kind of scary to think that we're living in a country where you can potentially get deported because of your faith. I don't know if you can tell by the way I look or how I speak or not spoken to, but I wouldn't do well in the Middle East. The closest I've come to the desert was Coachella. And getting stoned was a much different experience. But if I did have to be shipped back to the Middle East by my parents for my safety, wouldn't I kind of be like Will Smith in The Fresh Prince when he moves to Bel Air? But the reverse. I'm basically the Fresh Princess of Baghdad, guys. And I'll leave you with my theme song if you'd like to hear it. In the Western Hemisphere, born and raised with the white kids is where I spent most of my days. My parents had an accent, which I thought was kind of cool. I used to brag all about it when I went to school. And then a billionaire guy who was up to no good started hating all minorities in the neighborhood. I marched at one little protest. My mom got scared and said, "You're moving back to Baghdad and you're covering your head." Thank you guys, I'm really done.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yes, I mean, like, I've been learning about stand-up comedians from doing this show. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do this show. How did you get into your rhythm or your flow or your topic choice? Or how did you, like, kind of think about your vision as a comedian to deliver what you wanted to?
That's a good question. I think what's interesting is it's not as strategic as I intended it to be. The more I perform, the more I calculate. The more I'm like, okay, well, this is what I want to say, and this is how I'm going to get there. I think at first when I started out, it was just talk about something that I know is funny and tell stories that I'm already telling in real life. Because even when I write my material, it's hard for me not to sound too literary when I'm trying to write a joke. It sounds like it's too, you know, set up for the punchline, and it doesn't read as well on stage. And so I had to kind of sit back and look at who I was and what I was representing in my friend group and at work, and like, when I met people on the street, and bubble, you know, those jokes out and take them and have that represent who I am. Because I guess that really is who you are in conversation. Yep. And it's interesting because I'm so new, I'm in this like metamorphosis stage. I'm trying to figure out how to, you know, sure tap into my background and experience and who I am, but then also use it as, you know, a diving board or a jumping board to actually talk about other topics that are occurring in my life that have nothing to do with being Arab or Muslim or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like a learning process.
You're only like 8-9 months in. I mean, yeah. It's going to take, you know, I mean, to come as far as you've come in this short period of time is very remarkable. Mm-hmm. And you'll just get better and better and better. But yeah, I mean, that's just you have such a strong point of view for for a comic that's just so new.
It's just been, like, pressured on the inside the entire time.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that although I've only been doing it on a stage for a short amount of time, like, I've been a stand-up comedian my entire life, right? Even when I was a kid, I would always find those situations where I could get in front of a large group of people and say what I had to say. And
right.
In college, I went to the University of Denver, studied marketing, but even at that, like, I would love being the one to give pitch presentations. You know, I would compete in it. I even won this competition in Germany called World Business Dialogue where we had... It was like this crazy project where you were teamed up with like 5 people from different countries, and in like a weekend you had to create a business idea and pitch it to like the leading executives in Europe. And I was like, I got this, because I'm the only native English speaker. But but I loved it, because I love having a stage presence and saying what I wanted to say and then like throwing in some humor there. And I think we're all comedians when it comes down to it.
Well, it's something I asked Eddie too a long time ago. It's like, so did you like always, were you always the class clown? Like, did you always want to just make people laugh? Because I used to goof around all the time. But when I think of like the thought of like going up and doing comedy on a stage, it's terrifying. I'm like, oh my God. Like honestly, I've learned from doing the show and interviewing comedians like yourself, stand-up comedy is like one of these unbelievable art forms. And one of the things that people don't, like, they take for granted, something that, you know, Eddie, you and I talked about, it's you know, you never have a rehearsal. You can't rehearse. Your rehearsal is your performance. Mm-hmm. And, like, whittling that performance down to where you want it to be is the art. And you do that as a spectacle from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. You know, like, musicians, we rehearse. We write something behind closed doors. It's like, you know, there's something that that we gain that perspective from that. I mean, there is a thing about performing a song and then getting feedback, but it's very different. And Eddie, you were the one that really showed me that. Like when comedians go up, their rehearsal is their performance, and they're gauging like how good a joke is. You could have a great joke and, you know, say it in front of like a group of five people at a comedy club that, you know, it's just a bad night, and it could be a great joke that doesn't give you that release that you're like, oh, okay, this is where it needs to be. So how do you kind of like gauge that as a new comedian? Mm-hmm. That's like a real, it's a very alive process for you now. Like, how are you kind of like changing material or kind of whittling it down to get it perfected?
Definitely. I think the word alive actually is perfect for this because it's such a living, breathing art form. And I think the best comedians are the ones who can, you know, get on a stage and have a loose idea of what they want to talk about and then just talk, right? Because at the end of the day, it's your thoughts. You're the one who thought them up. It's not like you have to have a memorized set and routine. And I remember I was in Detroit, and I was doing my first comedy festival called the 1001 Laughs Dearborn Festival. And a comedian named Tehran, who actually has a show, has a couple shows at Laugh Factory.
Yeah, I know Tehran.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So he saw me rehearsing in the hallway. And I was just like going over my jokes because I, you know, I have like a bank of jokes I would probably use. And for this specific show, I like had an outline of I'm going to go from here to here to here to here. And so I was going over to my head, and he like kind of joked around. He's like, "It's not a play. Like you're not right. rehearsing your scenes. This is your voice. Just tell your story." And I think that was the first chip, you know, away at this script I had in my mind.
I think we all start off like. I mean, when I start off, I would write everything out longhand.
Yeah.
Like, it would be pages, and I would get up on stage and recite them word for word, and there's no connection. You can't make a connection with the audience that way. And then you just learn, like, okay, I'm going to talk about this, and I'm going to talk about this, and if this doesn't go here, then it'll go over there. I mean, it becomes a fluid thing, and like, when you're doing music, I think, it's like, I'm doing my song, I'm going to get my song out the way we've rehearsed it 1,000 times, and that's what we're going to do, and you guys are going to applaud when
we're
done.
And there's still, like, moments where you do choose your adventure, but you know, this is how it's going to start. This is where it's going to go.
But every comedy show is a unique experience in and of itself. And the only time as a comedian, I think, from my experience, you really have a rehearsed set and you're doing it and you want to go a certain way is a television taping.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
If you're doing a television show.
But you would think that's when you don't want to do that, right?
No, if you have 5 minutes on Conan, you want that 5 minutes to be...
It's five clean minutes.
It's five tight, clean minutes because it's not about connecting with the audience. It's about doing it for the camera. But every other time, it's for making a connection with the audience.
Exactly.
And you can't make that connection when you're in your head, remembering what you're trying to say.
Exactly. I will say the best experience I had, I won a competition a couple weekends ago.
I was just about to bring that up.
Right. Yeah, so you know, it was awesome. Obviously, it was awesome to win. And Tehran actually won first place at that competition. So it's a cool collision of worlds. But the funny thing is, I had written a completely new set because, or like let's say 75% new because I have a big show coming up in London that I need a lot of new material for. And so I rehearsed it that day, and I was like, I got this. And I got on stage, I said my opening line, and then I think the second joke didn't work as well as I thought it would, and I completely blanked on my entire script.
Wow.
Completely, it's never happened before. Like, down to the, I have no idea what I'm going to say. But I didn't admit it. That was the thing. I was like, I'm just going to run with it, and I'm just going to tell what I think. And then I started jumping around for my script. I think it was a 2-page script, or let's say 3-page script. And I jumped around from, like, page one to the bottom, page two, back to page one to page three, and, like, back and forth and back and forth. So I had the jokes, you know,
in, like, a storage.
Yeah, it was in my muscle memory. So once I, like, had the idea of what to say, I was like, okay, here. And then I would say the joke very fluidly. But I think that was, like, the best experience ever because I was like, oh, wait.
The longer you do it, the more all that will just fade away.
Yeah.
And it'll just be, everything will be there.
Yeah.
And you can just recall anything you need to at any moment. Mm-hmm. Unless you have a certain joke where it's like, okay, I'm setting up right here and I have to do a callback at a certain point.
Exactly.
And then you realize when you get that call back, you're like, fuck, I didn't do the setup. But that's the only other, any other time, it's just a hodgepodge and you just go up there.
Exactly, yeah. And then it's all about, I mean, people love your jokes. They love the order of the jokes. I think I was so concentrated and focused on, like, having it flow naturally from, like, point A to point B to point C. But at the end of the day, they're buying you when they come to see your stand-up, right?
Right.
Like, it's your likability. It's, like, your personality and how you tell the joke and how you walk around. How good looking you are. So that's why.
Yeah. Well, no one leaves a comedy show going, that comic, the way she flowed through her jokes from the beginning to the left. No, they don't do that. They're like, she was funny. That one joke was great. Yeah. I mean, that's how people recall a comedy show.
The way her hips flowed from side to side.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the funny thing, too, like, I love comedy shows. I go to comedy shows all the time. And I really, like, you see like so many comedians, and you know when somebody's funny when they're just, it's like joke after joke after joke is just funny. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that's hard about audiences when they go to, you know, you think they're going to laugh, they would be easygoing. But man, you have a couple seconds or, you know, 30 seconds where you something doesn't work the way you want to, that audience can turn on you in a second. And I think that's what's crazy about how you guys do what you do, you know. So I want to ask both of you this question. You know, Reem, you've just been doing this for about a year, a little over a year, about a year.
Say a year, yeah.
And Eddie, you've been doing it for a while. So, you know, as comedians, when you're like whittling stuff down and you always want to make new stuff, you know, like present in your routine, what's that balance of like banking on those jokes that you know that can work versus going for the new stuff that you really want to try out? Because I mean, it's like I feel the same about new songs. Like, oh, my audience wants to hear this, but I want to play this new three songs, you know. So I have to find this balance of like, I can't really place all of those in a set sometimes. You know, it's going to be three different shows in a way. So how do you kind of... I want to ask Reem first and then Eddie. I want to get your perspective.
Okay.
No cheating that way. No cheating.
I'm just going to do some research.
He's Googling it. I see him. I definitely think my answer is going to be different than his. But I try to read the audience before I go up every single time. So I did a show in Amsterdam and I was well aware that English was their second language. But I tried to, like, localize my humor just a little bit. Like, I knew there's, like, the general consensus that they don't like Germans that much. So I changed one of my jokes that was, like, aggressive towards Muslims. I changed it to, like, oh, but you guys hate the Germans, so you understand. And they loved it. So I'll try to figure out who's going to be in the audience. I can't wait till I perform to just a group of Republicans in, like, Tennessee and die.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah. I can't wait for my last show. But I will say, like, there's some jokes that are obvious, right? Like, my opening line was usually, I'm Reem, I'm Muslim, unless Trump is elected, in which case I'm screwed or I'm fucked or whatever. And I had to change it. It's current tense, it's present tense now, which is crazy.
Right.
I think it's just, like, it's an open dialogue with yourself. And then if you really have a new joke that you need to try out, just try it out. Depends on how comfortable you are and who's in the audience, because sometimes, and especially in LA.
So you just swing for the fences no matter what.
I just swing, but it depends on my audience too. If I know people in the audience or I know there's like industry in the audience, then you got to do your best stuff, right?
Right.
And then put your other stuff on YouTube, wait till it hits, and then you feel comfortable making that your best stuff. But it's kind of give and take.
Good answer. Eddie?
I know. If I'm on the road and I'm doing like an hour somewhere, and those people are paid a lot of money to come out and laugh, and that's like, I know that's their night of entertainment for the week, I do all my best stuff.
Right.
Maybe I'll throw a new joke in the middle somewhere, but it's like, if you're that hour of entertainment and those people have put all that money in, and you know that, like, we don't go out a lot and this is our time. But in LA, it's different because people go all the time, most shows are a little more relaxed. Unless it's like a showcase with industry there, then you're doing a set where you're like, I do all these jokes in this order and this is the way I'm doing it. But most of the time in LA, it's sort of just like you get bored with your stuff and you're just like, I'm just going to go up and I'm going to try these new things. I have these jokes. I know if I need to end on a laugh or start on a laugh, I can open up with this or I can close with this. Or if I lose them with this new bit, I can bring them back with this. But for most of the time, you're trying new things.
You're experimenting.
Or you're taking your old stuff and adding new stuff to it or pulling it apart. I mean, you're just trying. I treat LA, I think a lot of comics do, like most club. I mean, not big shows, but like a lot of times when you go up in LA, it's like a gym. You're just trying out new things and, you know, trying to grow as a comic, you know.
Well, I mean, that's why I was asking, like, as an artist, you want to be doing new stuff all the time. So comedians have to use their performance.
Because I know there will be times when, like, I haven't really worked on a new joke for a couple weeks or something like that, and I'll go up and I'll do a set, and I'm like, and I end up doing a bunch of old jokes in the set, and I get down, I just feel awful. Even though the people were laughing, I'm like, right, that was a waste of 10 minutes.
But do you do open mics or what are they called, like workout rooms and stuff like that, or you do booked shows?
I don't do open mics. I don't really do open mics anymore. Yeah. I do book shows a couple times a week.
So that's my issue, too, is I should be doing more open mics, but I don't really. I just do my booked shows. So when I go do those shows, I'm still a beginner. I kind of want to do my
You
best,
need to impress so, people yeah. so you can get booked again. I mean, exactly. I've been doing it long enough where I can kind of like get booked shows because I've been doing it long enough. But, I, you know, if I was newer, I would probably be trying to do every time I went up, I would try to kill with my best stuff just so I would come back or whatever.
As an Arab, that comes naturally to me.
Yeah, yeah. You just murder everybody.
Let's kill everybody.
So, Reem, tell us about this competition that you did in Anaheim recently.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. This was the funniest thing ever. So, it was the National Association of NAAPOC. It was the National Association of Air Professionals of Orange County. There you go.
Air nice. Professionals?
Air Professionals of Orange County.
Like airplane?
Arab.
Oh, Arab. Yeah. I thought you said Arab.
I promise, guys, I have white friends. I'm not that Arab. But it just comes across. Anyway, so it was that competition. Sponsored by the CIA. I died.
No, like, they were just registering everybody.
Right? I was like, I don't want to make jokes here. Please, do I have to?
Like, really? This is not good. Is this recorded? Yes, it is.
Yeah, exactly.
They were assessing threat levels.
Long live King Trump.
That's crazy.
Really nice. Yeah. So, that was like a specific show that was, you know, talked about who I was, blah, 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 blah. But it was cool. I got added super last minute because I'm going to be – there's a documentary called Make Me Laugh. And it's – ironically enough, it's featuring Russell Peters, who's like my, you know, first
guy. I saw that on your Facebook page.
Yeah. Russell Peters. Maz Jobani's going to be in it. Tehran's going to be in it. There's a bunch of people. And the producers of that documentary let me know about the show like a day in advance. And so they somehow got me on. And then I won third place, so I really feel bad for fourth place.
Damn.
This girl comes out.
Don't feel bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's good. You need to do that.
Exactly, yeah. So, but yeah, that was a show that I completely forgot everything I said. But I did debut a couple jokes. So I think because I didn't know anyone in the audience, even though it was a competition, I didn't really know anyone there. So I was like, you know what? There's no industry. There's no one, you know, my coworkers or friends or whatever. So I'm just going to say what I want to say.
Well, sometimes when you do those new jokes, you have that new energy to them.
Yeah.
And it'll work better than you thought it would.
Exactly.
And then you'll try it again the second show, and it'll eat dick. But there's that thing about that new joke. When you do it for the first time, there's an energy to it, and it will kill.
I will say I tried it out for a second time in front of my parents last weekend, and the joke was about my dad. And it went over well, too. And he thought it was funny, too. So it all worked.
There you go.
Exactly.
He's like, ha, ha, ha. I don't like this.
Well, the funny thing, so the joke is about how, you know, first-generation kids, like, they can't really have the same open relationship that, you know, white kids do with their parents. So, like, for example, my parents tried to convince me that humans had an organ called a golden bladder for half my life. And then they get mad at you when you try to correct them. Like, no, it's a gold, like a gallbladder. No. It's a golden bladder, right? So, like, the only solace we get is when we turn their ignorance against them. Like, we got a puppy once, and, like, any respectable Middle Eastern family, we named it after our favorite designer brand. So I had a border collie named Gucci. And my dad thought that was too emasculating of a name for a male dog. It's like, you know, Gucci, it is a bit too gay, so let's call him Gooch for short. So the joke is, and this is all really, totally true, by the way. So the joke is, I'm like, yeah, you know, a Gooch, for those of you who don't know, is a very specific area, you know, the taint, right?
Yes.
Right between, you know, it's no man's land, the shadow realm, the upside down, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, it is a very...
The front butt.
Gay name. The front butt, there you go. And then, I'll make it quick, but the joke culminates in the fact that my dog ran away once, and my dad just put up posters all around the neighborhood, like, lost Gooch, please call. I was driving up down the road, like, where is my Gooch?
Yeah. Have you seen my Gooch?
Posts on Craigslist, started getting like phone calls in the middle of the night, like, hello, have you seen my Gooch?
And you're like, oh, this is terrible.
Right?
This is bad.
So he found out right then and there, and he was like, oh, I already knew. But my mom had no idea. She's like, what? There's a third hole on men? I'm confused. What's going on?
Your dad's like, oh, yeah, this looks bad, but it's okay.
Right?
It's in the love of the dog.
He's like, joke's on you, motherfucker.
I like when you talk about your parents. It's hilarious. Let's get to another one of your clips. What are we going to play next?
This is from the haha. I'm Muslim unless Trump is elected.
Yes, this is pre.
I like it.
Trump dynasty.
All right, here we go.
I'm Reem. I'm Muslim unless Trump is elected, in which case I'm fucked. I asked my parents why they chose to name me a word which in English means either to penetrate something at a high velocity or a bulk amount of paper. My dad was like, well, we did not want you to get bullied, so we chose something aggressive but also office appropriate.
Oh
from Iraq. They immigrated here in the 80s. And what's interesting, growing up in a first-generation household, you start to notice a lot of cultural differences. Like, I love watching my parents watch TV. My dad will put on America's Funniest Home Videos. They put the cat in the bathtub. That does not belong there. That's like a woman in the workplace. There are a lot of misconceptions about Arabs and Muslims. For example, people think Islam is a religion rooted in violence, when the word literally means peace in Arabic. Or people think that we hate all non-Muslims. What is just the Jews? It's actually Ramadan right now, guys. Yeah, some people know. So for those of you who don't know, Ramadan is a super exciting holiday where you starve every day from sunrise to sunset for a month. I strictly observe Ramadan as a diet. Actually, I did lose weight prior to Ramadan this year. I made some lifestyle choices. So I stopped eating foods like bread, rice, pasta, solids. And it's been great. Well, I mean, I had to, though, because I'm 25, and so I have a lot of really important life events coming up that I have to look good for. Like Coachella. I mean, I love Coachella. My nickname is Ringchella. I'm an Instagram guy. But it's always such a struggle, Chella, getting there. Like, people forget. There's so many costs associated with attending a music festival. There's, like, the hotel room, the gas, the clothes, the drugs. I'm just kidding. I don't buy my own drugs. Why do you think I'm that skinny? But, I mean, it's hard. It's hard being a Muslim at a music festival. Actually, it's hard being Muslim. Like, for example, you're expected to pray 5 times a day. Okay. It's hard for me to pray on the go. Because in a post 9/11 world, any public Muslim activity is suspicious. I can't pray on an airplane. Nothing gets a flight attendant's attention like asking, excuse me, which way is Mecca? Another thing that irks me is this whole 72 virgins thing. Have you guys heard about it? Yeah. That might sound like a fantasy for men, but fucking awkward for women. Heaven sounds a lot like freshman year of high school, which sounds a lot like hell. Like, the last thing I want to do is die and be greeted at the pearly gates by an acne-riddled virgin holding a sign like, hi, I'm Zach, number 38, welcome to Paris. Oh, I just came. Guys, the punchline to that joke is my parents think I'm showing up to heaven a virgin. Sorry, Dad. Arab parents, honestly, they just want you to be happy. As long as it also makes them happy. Like, my mom was like, my bulk little paper. You can marry anyone you like. As long as he's Arab. And Muslim. And Iraqi. From the south of Iraq. And a doctor. A neurologist. With an office in Encino. Follow your heart. So you might have guessed that I have intimacy issues. And it might be because Arab parents fail to admit that intimacy exists. Like, every Muslim girl has the exact same sex talk with her mother. I remember mine like it was yesterday. I was 13, and my mom, she took me aside, she sat me down, looked me in the eyes, and tenderly said, don't. Thanks, guys. I'm really glad.
Yeah. That was good. Good.
This was very good. Very good.
Very good.
Trying to make sure this doesn't start again. Okay, there we go.
You know what's cool is that you actually like have your first shows up online. That's awesome. A lot of like comedians and artists, they're scared to do that. And I'm like, no, that stuff only holds merit as you keep doing it.
Yeah.
And then you look back 10 years, 15 years at these old shows,
exactly.
And you're like, man, this is what I did back then. And it carries so much value.
I mean, I'm already cringing listening to it.
No, I have my first set ever buried in the closet.
Why don't you put that up online?
Fuck no.
You're like, never.
Fuck no.
I will say that, so the clip went semi-viral literally like the night after the election because of the title. Like now it's at like 200,000 views, which I think like for
that's
a first
amazing.
Video is pretty good, right?
Yeah. That's amazing.
So my solace is that I made a little bit of money off of Trump. I was like, yes.
Yes.
Like, this is great.
Take that.
Exactly. But it also helped me get like a bunch of other gigs that I would have never gotten otherwise.
Well, let's talk about one of your other gigs coming up. You're going to London
for
this amazing event where you're hosting. Tell us about what's going on.
Yeah, so there's an event called Asian Comedy Night. It's going to be in London on April 8th, which is two Saturdays from now. And
it's perfect timing that you're on the show right now.
Yeah, no, I literally said this is amazing.
That's awesome.
This is what Allah does. Everybody converts. I'm just kidding.
You're half kidding.
No, because then they'll be like me, and then I won't be as funny and unique.
See, there you go.
Unicorn. Yeah, so they reached out to me, I think from that video, actually, because I hadn't posted the other video before. And they said they're hosting an event. I think it's called Asian Comedy Night because it's predominantly Indian, Pakistani, and Punjabi comedians. And then they threw me in there, and they're like, all right, we need something to label all of them together Asian. but it's like the biggest set of my career.
Are they flying you out there?
Flying me out there. Yeah, it's really exciting. It's going to be at the Watford Coliseum. It's like a 1,200-person.
That's incredible.
Isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
And they so they asked me to be the compere of the evening, which I agreed to without Googling, and compere is the host. So I was like, oh, shit.
So how does that work? You do like a minute, 2 minutes up front, 3 minutes, and then you do like...
It's going to be like a 10-ish minute set up front, and then going to introduce like the comedians, like a minute in between each comedian.
You'll have like a minute, 2 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think 5 minutes, there's intermission, so it's going to be 5 minutes.
And they warm back up before it starts again?
Yeah, 5 minute set, and then one and two, and one and two, and then another 5 minutes at the end. And then the headliner is Paul Chowdhury, who I'm told is like the UK's Russell Peters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Google confirmed. Siri done told me that's true.
Like, so. That is. You know, I actually met Russell Peters.
Did you really?
I saw him at the John Lovitz Comedy Club.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I was like, hey, man, you know, I'm Indian. He's like, I'm Indian. I'm like, you know, I said I was born in Canada. He's like, I was born in Canada.
No way.
And I was like, I'm playing the Apollo Theater in like 2 weeks. And he's like, dude, I play the Apollo. I was like, I know. And he was like, we got to hang out, man.
Oh,
and I've never seen him since, but he was such a great guy. And one thing I did notice about his act that I was really impressed with,
yeah.
I think I've told you this, Eddie, like he had nothing rehearsed and literally just asked people in the room for an hour and a half, what do you do? Where are you from?
And
he would just ream and heckle. Ream? and he just like heckled these people.
Yeah.
Into these bits that, I mean, I was crying laughing because he's like such a great ethnic comic. Like, he makes fun of everybody, and yet he brings all the cultures together. Like, he's really found this like cool marketplace.
Definitely.
So, do you see, like, being an ethnic comedian, do you see that that's like something that you might be like something that a bonus that will come from audiences that you perform in front of?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what I do love about Russell Peters is he found a way to bridge the gap between so many different racial groups. And it's not that I want to like stray away from that, you know, I don't want that to be the message anyone takes away from this, but I want to like be broader, right? And I think he does such a good job of saying like, I'm Canadian, but like, you know, Asians and Indians and all these crazy things, Mexicans, he makes fun of everyone and then brings them all together. So that's definitely something I want to emulate in my career. And I think I made this point earlier that I strayed away, but Russell Peters was one of the best comedians for me growing up because he was family-friendly material.
Yeah.
And I think that was, like, huge because there's not a lot you can watch, like I said, with your family. And for us, like, Russell Peters was, like, an event.
No, he's amazing, and he's a great influence. Real quick, where can people find you?
I'm on my website, which is reemedan.com, and my name is so weird, R-E-E-M-E-D-A-N. And I'm at Remy Dodd on Instagram, Facebook, and the Twitter.
And I have one more question, just because I ask every artist that comes here. Who are some of your biggest influences?
Oh, that's great.
Besides Russell Peters.
Besides Russell Peters. Oh, my gosh. I'm so on the spot.
You don't have to have any. It's fine.
Yeah, you can just say nobody. Like,
you can be a standalone person.
Yeah, I will say Louis C.K. is huge.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, I love Louis C.K. There's like a slew of other people. Dave Chappelle. it's a big one for me. Russell Peters is another one. At one point, Carlos Mencia was in there as like the family comedian.
Yeah.
I don't know how. But yeah, I just those meals.
Interesting that you didn't mention one woman.
Amy Schumer.
Okay, there you go.
I have nothing against. I like her, and I think what she's done with her career is incredible, and she's found a way to transform her artwork into so many different mediums, which is great. Like, she's a screenwriter, and she's a screenwriter, and all those things. And I just think she's such a go-to answer. So it's probably actually nothing against her. She's just such a go-to answer, I think, in the industry today.
No, but she's good. I mean, there's people that are, like, there's people that, I think Whoopi Goldberg from the 80s mm-hmm. is amazing.
I think
Ellen
is a huge
Ellen is too. Amazing, too, you know. There are female comedians that I think are amazing, mm-hmm. you know. So, but I was just interested, you know, with your answer because you are a female comedian. I want to see who you're influenced by.
Exactly.
Reem, you were such an awesome guest. You're going to have to come back.
I would love to.
You're performing in London 2 weeks, April 8th, one more time. Where are you performing April 8th?
April 8th at the Watford Coliseum, the Asian Comedy Night. I think you can find it on the Google.
Awesome. Cool. Reemadon.com, the comedian. Mm. That's my own little tag. We'll see you guys next
Thanks.
Week.
Back.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence.